We always like to get something having to do with spoken word in our conventions because, I don't know, I feel close to spoken word since that's one of my major areas of specialty as well. Bob O'Brien is going to be doing a presentation about Shakespeare, and that certainly is, although it's musical words, it's still a spoken word. Bob O'Brien is Associate Professor of English at West Virginia Wesleyan College, a graduate of LSU. He's received both his MA and PhD from the University of Iowa. He's given many presentations on spoken recordings, covering topics from stage English to the recordings of Booth, Irving, Terry, Burbeck, and others. He is a recipient of the Fall 1985 James Still Fellowship to write the first book on the history of recordings of Shakespeare's works. Here's Bob O'Brien.
Thank you. I might say I appreciate the work of Peter Bergman, so following him, I don't feel that I'm totally out of place. Besides, I think Peter's work is first rate. I might give credit to the Carnegie Mellon Foundation, which provided the Still Fellowship, which made at least much of my work of this year possible. The piece I have today is called The First Trace, the Marlowe and Southern recording of the balcony scene from Romeo and Juliet. E.H. Southern and Julia Marlowe were noted performers before Southern divorced his first wife and before he and Marlowe decided to join their careers. Each had achieved some success in performances of Shakespeare before they married, but subsequently they made a profession out of performing Shakespeare's plays. They were greatly admired. William Winter, the turn-of-the-century drama critic, wrote his biography of Tyrone Power Sr. explicitly as a way of promoting him as the successor to Southern as the leading actor of the day. Winter was lavish in his praise of Marlowe's performance in their 1905 production of Twelfth Night. He wrote, "She possessed the personal beauty, the sensibility, temperament, and the melodious, sympathetic voice requisite for the part. And in the acting of it, her art was so fine and under such admirable control that she created the illusion of truth without sacrificing the enchantment of poetry." These two important performers were well past their primes when they first recorded their performances in 1920 and 21. Southern was 61 and Marlowe 55. But when they gave recording their attention, what they produced was most ambitious and innovative. No other performer of Shakespeare attempted so much until Orson Welles did five shortened versions of whole plays in 1938, 39, and 1940. According to Rust, they made 57 matrices of recordings of Shakespeare, far more than the combined efforts of all previous performers. 13 recordings were eventually issued. The recording of the balcony scene from Romeo and Juliet is of special importance because it is the first recording of this well-known scene from one of Shakespeare's most popular plays. Let me interject here. I have 12 of those 13 recordings. If you want to help me get the 13th, I'd appreciate it. The extraordinary tenacity of this couple and their concern with recording this particular piece is evidenced in their recording history. The first piece Marlowe and Southern attempted when they went to the recording studio was the balcony scene from Romeo and Juliet. The date was April 14, 1920, and the matrix was rejected. Southern then tried three separate speeches, none of which produced a satisfactory matrix. The next day, April 15th, Southern returned to the Camden studio, where he made six more matrices of three speeches. All were rejected. On May 24th, he returned to make four matrices of two speeches. All were rejected. On October 25th, Marlowe joined him to make four matrices of two scenes from The Taming of the Shrew. All were rejected. The next day, they returned to record the balcony scene again, this time in two parts. The first was a one-part recording. The four matrices they made were rejected. The following day, Southern returned to make 6 more matrices of the same 3 speeches he had attempted in the first recording session back in April. All 6 were rejected. On Thursday, October 28th, Southern's first acceptable recordings were made. 3 matrices containing the 7 ages of man from As You Like It and Antony's 2-part oration over the body of Caesar. He returned with Marlowe the next day to produce 2 more matrices, both of which were rejected. The following Monday began with Southern's successful recording of a soliloquy from Hamlet, and then Marlowe joined him to make takes 3 and 4 of the 2-part version of the balcony scene. The 4th effort was accepted 6 months after their first attempt. By way of comparison, it might be mentioned that Ellen Terry's 5 recordings came from merely 10 matrices recorded during only 1 session. Of all the recordings of Marlowe and Southern, none is more likely to be known than the 2-part rendering of the balcony scene from Romeo and Juliet. The performers were famed for these roles, and this is the first recording of this scene. The recording is of great importance because it is the first primary evidence we have of oral acting style in one of the most popular of Shakespeare's works. The reading they record is essentially a heavily cut portion of Act 2, Scene 2 in the version found in the Cambridge Shakespeare and a variety of editions published about the turn of the century. It differs somewhat from the most commonly used recent editions. One of the distinctive passages consists of the final speeches, lines 183 through 190, in the Cambridge Shakespeare version. I mention this so that you will understand why the roles are different, are reversed, the lines are reversed in such recent recordings as that of Zeffirelli, of the Zeffirelli Romeo and Juliet. The editors have changed the assignment of lines. The originality of this recording is evident in the opening seconds, where crowd noises and background music are used to set the scene. Southern uses crowd noises in his recording of Antony's speech from Julius Caesar, evidently for the first time in a literary recording. I know that there are people here who know a lot more than I do, and I want you to check me about this. I'm opining that the first use of crowd noises as background to a speech is in Southern's recording of Antony's speech from Julius Caesar. If you can find one earlier than that, I wish you'd tell me about it. At the beginning, it is used to establish that a party is in progress, but that musical passage ends during Romeo's initial line.
Never felt a wound. Ah, what light through yonder window breaks? It is the east, and Juliet is the sun.
It is used to develop when the music returns at line 163, obviously cued by the end of line 162. It is used to develop the mood of the final part of the scene.
Dear love,
swear, do not swear. Although I joy in thee, I have no joy of this contract tonight. It is too rash, too unadvised, too sudden, too like enlightenment, which does seem to be, for one can say, enlightened. Sweet, good night. This bird of love, by summer's ripening breath, may prove a beauteous flower when next we meet. Good night. Good night, I sleep with pearls and rest. comes from thy heart has sat within my breast.
Oh, wilt thou leave me so unsatisfied?
What satisfaction canst thou have tonight?
The exchange of thy love, faithful vow, for mine.
I gave thee mine, before thou didst request it, and yet I would it were to give again.
Would thou withdraw it? For what purpose, love?
But to be frank, and give it thee again. I hear some noise within. Dear love, adieu. Alone, good man. With Montague, true. Stay but a little, I will come again.
Oh, blessed, blessed night. Have a fear being at night. All this is for a dream. So flattering, sweet, to be so handsome.
In a word, dear Romeo, our good night in vain. But should thy vent of love be honorable, thy perfect marriage, send a word tomorrow by one that I'll secure to come to thee, where and what time thou wilt perform the rite, and all my fortunes at thy foot I'll lay, and follow thee in a lord throughout the world.
Heaven!
I'm just a lord! But if thou meanest not well, I do beseech thee.
Heaven!
Father, I come! Beseech thy suit, and leave me to my grief. Tomorrow will I send.
So thrive, my soul.
A thousand times, good night.
A thousand times the worse to want thy life. Love goes taught now, as schoolboys from their books. But love, taught with every look.
Romeo! Romeo!
Oh, what fortunate fight! The only chance is get us back again. The bondage is false, and may not speak aloud. Else would I tear the cave where Echo lies, and make her airy tongue more forth than mine, with repetition of your Romeo's name. Romeo!
Soul that calls upon this name, how silver sweet sound lover tongues by night, like softest music to a tender ear.
Romeo!
My dear!
At what o'clock tomorrow shall I send to thee?
At the hour of nine.
I will not fail. It's 20 years till then. I have forgot why I did call it that.
Let me stand here till thou rememberest.
I shall forget to have thee still. Stand there, remembering how I love thy company.
And I'll still stay to have thee still forget, forgetting any other home but this.
It is almost morning. I would have thee gone, and yet no further than a wanton bird, who lifts his hop a little from her hand, and with a silk thread plucks it back again. So loving, jealous of his liberty.
I would I was thy bird.
Sweet, so would I, that I should thrill thee with much cherishing. Good night, good night. Fasten with such sweet sorrow that I shall say good night till it be morrow.
Sleep well upon thine eyes, peace in thy breast. Would I were sleep and peace so sweet to rest.
The addition of crowd noises and background music adds enormously to the dramatic effectiveness of the recording. Who was the person who made the imaginative leap of asking for these additions? We will probably never know. However, what we find in this recording is merely an elaboration of what was done when Southern recorded Antony's speech 4 days earlier. The idea could have come from a recording technician or a bystander, but it could have been Southern himself who, dissatisfied with his just completed recording of the scene from As You Like It, called for some extra people to be brought into the recording studio and rehearsed them to perform as a crowd. The matrices of the two earlier attempts at the balcony scene would be very helpful in determining when this important change was introduced. Southern has much the smaller part in this scene. His delivery is excessively slow, but certain pronunciations deserve mention. In his opening speech, he clearly uses the two-syllable pronunciation of the heroine's name. Notice he says Juliet, not Juliet. And that's his pronunciation is just what is needed in this line.
What light through yonder window breaks? It is the and Juliet is the sun.
Allow me a moment to explain the relationship between pronunciation and poetic meter in this line. In a line of blank verse, the verse form most commonly used by Shakespeare, 10 syllables are arranged so that each even-numbered syllable receives more stress than the preceding odd-numbered syllable. An extra unaccented syllable can be added at the end of the line without violating the meter. But in this line, sun, it is the east, and Juliet is the sun. Sun needs to be accented because it is a noun. The only way to get 10 syllables out of these lines, out of these 9 words, is to pronounce the name in 2 syllables, Juliet, not Juliet. Notice what happens when we shorten the pronunciation of the name. The vowels which are next to one another in the second and third syllables, Juliet. The vowels which are next to one another in the second and third syllables join to produce a consonant vowel complex, yet. Linguists call this phenomena synesthesis. It is very common. It is used by all of us. And in no sense is it a form of incorrectness. In the passages I discuss, a number of examples where it occurs and should occur will be noted. Of the 38 occurrences of this name in the play, on 32 occasions, 38 times the name occurs in the play, on 32 occasions, the poetic meter requires that the name be reduced through synesthesis to 2 syllables. Some recent performers locked themselves into a trisyllabic pronunciation, which they used throughout the play. Southern shows how the name ought to be pronounced in this line. His pronunciation is also felicitous in lines 198 and 199, although Shakespeare almost consistently requires a monosyllabic pronunciation of T-O-W-A-R-D. Say the word. T-O-W-A-R-D. Shakespeare requires a monosyllable there, toward. Recent performers, especially recent English performers, almost consistently pronounce the word in 2 syllables, toward. Shakespeare, or Southern, does it right.
Love goes toward love, as schoolboys from their books, but love.
By the way, in modern text, the word is frequently spelled. Oh, however, and again, Southern does it right here. However, in line 183, he ignores the need to syncopate the word flattering, F-L-A-T-T-E-R-I-N-G. He says flattering in 3 syllables. It should be reduced through syncopation to flat-ring, flat-tring. Here it is. By the way, in modern text, the word is frequently spelled with an apostrophe in the place of the E to indicate the syncopation. Such a spelling in this instance is not used in any of the early editions of this play. When such spellings are used with other words in early editions, we cannot attribute those spellings to Shakespeare. He did not publish his own plays, and the typesetters are usually thought to have decided what spellings to use of such words. In modern editions, the responsibility belongs with the editor. The reader cannot depend upon the occurrence of an apostrophe to decide that a word should be syncopated. The rhythm and interpretation of the line determine when to pronounce the word in two syllables and when to pronounce it in three. The reader must simply internalize the rhythm of the blank verse line. Southern should have pronounced the word correctly, regardless of what his text had on the page. For Shakespeare, the final word in the line was pronounced in four syllables, substantial. Southern pronounces it in three. The result of Southern's reading is a metrical chaos, too flattering, sweet, to be substantial. Notice he uses synesthesis in this last word where Shakespeare did not want it to be used. The flow of the line is thoroughly lost, and indeed Southern's measured delivery in this scene is decidedly unmusical. The 54-year-old Julia Marlowe was always more admired for her beauty and vivacity than for her vocal performance. Indeed, early in her career, she had received rather sharp criticism for the way she recited her lines. In her maturity, however, her skill was widely applauded, and attention to her recordings assures the listener that Julia Marlowe had extraordinary vocal skill. But this is not to say that her vocal style should be imitated. She made a number of changes in her speeches, some of which are quite benign and some of which seriously corrupt the meter. A few lines later, at line 101, Marlowe introduces an extra syllable in the line by neglecting the syncopation of uttering, which should be produced to uttering in.
Ears have not yet drunk 100 words that sound uttering, yet I know the sound.
Her verbal substitution delays her address to Romeo and makes the first part of her speech a comment to herself. In her next speech, she again disrupts the meter by inserting but at the beginning of line 104. It's very short. You'll have to listen for it. It's not in the text.
Be the fair maid, be the lady's like.
But how camest thou hither? Tell me, and wherefore?
At line 164, she introduces two extra syllables in a single line. By ignoring the synesthesis of beauteous, which should be pronounced beauteous, and by failing to note that the following word is monosyllabic. No, the word is not flower. It is flar, or should be.
May prove a beauteous flower when next we meet.
She makes a similar error by ignoring the syncopation in line 185.
But that I bring of love the honorable, thy purpose, marriage, and...
These remarks suggest that Marlowe was rather negligent of Shakespeare's meter in the flow of his verse. But they do little to suggest why her audiences were so impressed with her performances. To get some idea of that, a consideration of her last speech may be useful. Lines 224 through 227. She diphthongizes the vowel of sweet so heavenly that it might be considered a two-syllable word, sue-eat. The rest of the line arches upward in an expressive curve, ending with a lingering I. The next line begins lower and more quickly before she again lingers over the final word. She then extends sweet again by diphthongizing the vowel until the word becomes sue, eat. She then lifts her register again as she diphthongizes the vowel in say and pauses significantly before the final phrase. She strives to make each word pregnant with meaning while removing all of the crisp quickness which might be found in Shakespeare's lines.
Sweet, or would I, that I should fill thee with much cherishing. Good night, good night. Darkness doth sweet sorrow, that I shall say good night till it be tomorrow.
That is also the case with her reading of her first line and the most famous line in the play, line 75. Marlowe says the line in three syllables, or says the line in three syllables, or says the name in three syllables, producing a metrical chaos of 14 syllables. What she says is, "Oh, Romeo, Romeo, wherefore art thou Romeo?" Now notice the point here. In that reading, the name is in three syllables. If you read that line, that name in three syllables, you end up with 14. That's not blank verse. Blank verse takes 10 or 11 syllables at most. But beyond that 14 syllables is an absolute metrical chaos. It has no rhythm at all. The blank verse line goes ba-bum, 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 ba-bum. In this line it goes ba-bum, ba-bum, bum, ba-bum, bum, 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 ba-bum. It is an absolute mess. And here is Julia Marlowe. In 14 syllables, Shakespeare certainly meant the name to be reduced through synesthesis to two syllables, Romeo, not Romeo, Romeo. Among more recent scholars, Kerkeritz points out this in Shakespeare's pronunciation. But as early as 1919, Ursula Irvine makes the same point in a book entitled How to Pronounce the Names in Shakespeare, a book prefaced by a commendatory letter from E.H. Southern. She makes the point that the name must be disyllabic in this line, although she doesn't know how to describe the synesthesis. What we are concerned with here is not merely a matter of correctness or even of the melody of Shakespeare's verse. A consideration of this line takes us to the heart of the play, the characterization of Juliet and the nature of the central events of the action. Let me begin by asking you to read the line or say it to yourself repeatedly, both in the 14-syllable version that Marlowe used and in the 11-syllable form that Shakespeare requires. I think I have Marlowe here.
Oh, Romeo, Romeo, wherefore art thou Romeo?
Now say that line as in 14 syllables as she says it to yourself a few times. I hope you have a pen, because I need that too. And now say the line in 11 syllables, saying the name Romeo rather than Romeo. Now write down the adjectives which describe the character who says the line in 11 syllables, and write down what adjectives you would use to describe the character who says the line in 14 syllables. In many sessions involving audiences ranging from elementary school children to college teachers, the adjectives offered for the longer 14-syllable version have been words such as languid, passive, sentimental, and weak. For the shorter version, the adjectives have been angry, assertive, petulant, and forceful. Marlowe's 14-syllable reading of the line is the one that conforms to the turn-of-the-century ideal for Juliet, an ideal carefully described by William Winter, who I quoted earlier. Notice the adjectives that Winter uses in this description of Juliet. If that afflicted woman is separated from her passion and misery, she fades into the realm, almost into the realm of conjecture. When first presented, she is beautiful, sweet, innocent, artless, obedient. Her heart has not been awakened, and her mind and will, contented in the physical joy of blooming youthful life, are pleased and passive. A crucial word, passive. This is the conception of the character which has dominated the stage for over four-fifths of this century. We must be impressed to find that, with one notable exception, every actress who has recorded this scene has read this line in 14 syllables, regardless of all the variety in pacing, inflection, and tone. Here is Eva Le Gallienne reading that famous line.
Oh, Romeo, Romeo, wherefore art thou, Romeo? Deny thy father and refuse.
Here is Susan Shintall.
Oh, Romeo, Romeo, wherefore art thou, Romeo?
Here is a young lady in a film made by the Royal Academy.
Oh, Romeo, Romeo, wherefore art thou, Romeo?
I've never heard of her again. Here is Claire Bloom.
Oh, Romeo, Romeo, wherefore art thou, Romeo?
And let's see, here is Pamela Brown. And here is an anonymous young lady from a recording made by some group calling itself the Young Shakespeareans.
Oh, Romeo, Romeo, wherefore art thou, Romeo?
Let me add that I found it significant that on the jacket cover, all of the lines read are quoted, and they're all printed as prose. That's the way they're read, too. And that is what we find in what will be the most accessible version of the play for some time. The television version, done as a part of the Shakespeare plays, with Rebecca Sayre playing Juliet as a straight-haired, breastless, prepubescent innocent.
Juliet is the sun. Arise, fair sun, and kill the envious moon, who is already sick and pale with grief that thou, her maid, art far more fair than she. Be not her maid, since she is envious. Her vestal livery is but sick and green, and none but fools do wear it. Cast it off. It is my lady. Oh, it is my love. Oh, that she knew she were. Yet she says nothing. What of that? Her eye discourses. I will answer it. I'm too bold, 'tis not to me she speaks. Two of the fairest stars in all the heaven, having some business, do entreat her eyes to twinkle in their spheres till they return. What if her eyes were there, they in her head? The brightness of her cheek would shame those stars as daylight doth a lamp. Her eyes in heaven would through the airy regions stream so bright that birds would sing and think it were not night. Oh, see how she leans her cheek upon her hand. Oh, that I were a glove upon that hand, that I might touch that cheek.
Hi, me.
She speaks. Oh, speak again, bright angel. For thou art as glorious to this night, being o'er my head, as is a winged messenger of heaven unto the white upturned wondering eyes of mortals that fall back to gaze on him when he bestrides the lazy pacing clouds and sails upon the bosom of the air.
Oh, Romeo, Romeo, wherefore art thou, Romeo?
Regardless of whether the actress is one of the great figures of the 20th century stage or an unknown on a recording meant to exploit the popularity of a film, regardless of whatever else the actress does with the line, each reads it in 14 syllables, and each seeks to make of Juliet the weak and artless creature that Winter admired. But the more weak and artless she becomes, the less she is responsible for what happens. As Winter has pointed out, the play becomes one of misery, the misery of a weak and naive but virtuous person overwhelmed by the forces of circumstance. It is not a tragedy dominated by the terror we feel when we find a flawed but virtuous person suffering as the result of some mistake that person has made. An Italian opera director was needed to properly develop a different Juliet. In Zeffirelli's film, Olivia Hussey presents a Juliet elaborately coiffed, full-figured, and confident of and delighted by her power over those around her. Strikingly also, she is the only actress on records who clearly strays from the 14-syllable standard.
Cheek.
Ah, me.
She speaks. Oh, speak again, bright angel.
Oh, Romeo, Romeo. Wherefore art thou, Romeo? Deny thy father and refuse thy name. Or if thou wilt not, be but sworn, my love, and I'll no longer be a Capulet.
Shall I hear more, or shall I speak
again? Ah, 'tis but thy name that is my enemy. Thou art thyself, though, not a Montague. What is Montague? It is nor hand, nor foot, nor arm, nor face, nor any other part belonging to a man. Oh, be some other name. What's in a name?
Notice the radical difference in physical type between this Juliet and the Rebecca Sayre that we saw earlier. Totally different conception of character. I want you to see, I could have used phono recordings here, but I want you to see how the shortened reading of that crucial line is associated with a different physical type and with a different conception of the character of Juliet. But a full treatment of that version must be delayed until its proper place. At this time, it is enough to say that Marlowe's performance is the first oral record we have of a tradition which has led performers into misunderstanding this young woman who sets the time and place, and into failing to recognize that for Shakespeare's time, racked with religious conflict, Juliet's claim that Romeo was the god of her idolatry was a very serious claim indeed. Shakespeare's Juliet is a willful and self-confident young lady. In the South, we have a name for such a type. She is a belle. We should add that we see how thoroughly Winter was misled when he remarked, "The love which she denoted was not the animal love which devours and destroys, that sensual frenzy which so much of contemporary criticism has declared to be the only genuine emotion, but the love which hallows, cherishes,
and would sacrifice life itself to promote the happiness of its object. Marlowe was evidently proud of the way she could say Romeo, for she revised a line so that she could utter the name in a most exaggerated three syllables. A reading of line 200 reminds us that Shakespeare expected his performers to keep meter even when their noises were non-verbal. But notice what Marlowe says. The last two lines of the speech also deserve attention. The version seen elsewhere in the text is that of the bad quarto. For the last line, the first folio has "with repetition of my Romeo," a normal blank verse line when the trisyllabic pronunciation of the name is used. The version of the first quarto ends up with 6 or 7 or even 8 stressed syllables, as it is in the reading by Marlowe. Any reading of the quarto's version is unmetrical, but the chaos is greatest in her version. Julia Marlowe was admired for her industry and ability to learn, but she clearly never applied herself to learning to recognize the meter of Shakespeare's verse. A study of the Marlowe and Southern recording of the balcony scene from Romeo and Juliet reminds us that after a certain point, we do not need to depend only upon the comments of reviewers and biographers to study oral acting style. Phono recordings are primary sources revealing what performers actually did. Literary recordings, particularly recordings of Shakespeare's works, deserve much closer attention than they have been given. In this case, we find in the first recorded example of this important scene fully developed evidence of the tradition which has corrupted performance of this play up to this time. The performances of Marlowe and Southern were probably not the origin of the sentimental interpretation of this play, but this recording does provide the first oral record of what that tradition produced in practice. In it, we find the bent twig which has grown to a many-branched but misshapen tree.